Have you ever heard of, or perhaps come across in the flesh, the little Japanese miniature sculptures called Netsuke? Well, if not, you'll find out about them in just a moment, because our writer tonight, Kate Nunn, has used one of these tiny sculptures as the centerpiece of her new novel called The Last Reunion. Four women who served in India and Burma during World War II in a unit called the Wasbys reunite in a castle in Ireland in 1999 to see out the millennium. And for one of them, there's unfinished business related to this Netsuke that's actually been missing since 1976. Well, Kate Nunn's written six books, including a number of historical fiction books. She lives on the Northern Rivers area of New South Wales. She joins me tonight on The Writers from the Lismore Studio. Hi, Kate. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So, Kate, describe to us what Netsuke are for those who might not be familiar with them.
They are now highly collectible Japanese toggles that are carved in the round and often out of ivory or cherry wood, a number of different sort of hard substances that can be carved. And they were originally used right up until the 18th century by Japanese men to, because they didn't have pockets in their kimonos, so they were used to fasten as a toggle to fasten something around their obi, the sash around their middle, and they might be carrying writing implements or tobacco pouches, that kind of thing. And the Netsuke were these incredibly decorated, just little toggles. So they were handled every day. Often the ones that are around from that era now are quite worn because they've been handled. But I was fascinated by them. I worked as a temp in my 20s and spent about 6 weeks at an art gallery and was assigned to the Asian department. And all I did was filing for 6 weeks. It was really quite tedious. But I did come across Netsuke then, and there was a big book on it, I remember, and I was just absolutely fascinated. And there were some examples of them. And so when I started writing, thinking about what book to write, what to write next and what subjects to focus on, that kind of, I dredged it up from my memory and the back of my mind and thought, well, you know, I've always been really interested in these. And I had read The Hare with Amber Eyes.
Oh, but, yes. The Image
which
of
is
Val
also
book,
about
yes.
Netsuke. Yes. So I started thinking, how would I include them in a story? And when I thought for a while, and I did a little bit of research into the time, the kind of 17th and 18th century Japan, but it wasn't exciting me enough. And so I thought, well, what about later, sometime in the 20th century, and when might a Netsuke have come into somebody's possession? And that's when I happened to be literally just Googling and reading Wikipedia, and I came across the Allies' involvement in the war in Burma, which really, it was the longest theatre of war in the Second World War. But it was known as the Forgotten War because they really did feel forgotten. Things that were happening in Europe sort of captured the press's attention in a far greater way.
So, okay, we'll sort of come to the Wasbys as well. But just back to the Netsuke, because the fascinating thing is, as you said, in Japan, right up until I think the time that Japan really started opening up to the West, these were daily items, even though they were so intricately carved. But then they became enormous collector's items, like incredibly well valued, didn't they?
Yes. They go at auction, they fetch hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's often quite hard to verify them because there are sometimes some of them have maker's marks, but some of those can be forged or counterfeit. So that's quite tricky. But those with a really solid long provenance really do fetch quite stratospheric amounts. I think because they're collector's items. You know, they're beautiful, they're decorative, they're quite playful. They can be animals or mythical creatures. Often they are animals, but done in a really playful way. And they're carved in the round, which is quite fascinating. And just the detail on them is extraordinary.
Now, you've imagined a Netsuke that you called the Fox Girl. I know you've made it up, I believe, because I went to Google it because I thought, oh, this sounds beautiful. I wonder if it's a real artifact, but it wasn't. But just describe what you've imagined for us.
Well, there are some Netsukes called the Fox Girl. There isn't one single Fox Girl, though. And it's based on a mythical creature of a woman that assumes the shape of a fox and I, from what I can remember, eats men. So it seemed like quite a kind of, quite an interesting topic or subject to choose. And she is, it's a fox that sometimes assumes the role, the form of a woman and vice versa. So it's kind of a bit of a chameleon.
Now, you've got this younger woman, Olivia. She's an Australian who heads over to London for a big overseas experience. And she ends up, strangely enough, doing filing in a in an art dealer. So obviously, you drew some personal experience there. I mean, how much of that reflected your own experience? Or was it really just the experience of all that filing that you put in?
It was the filing. And I thought, oh, yes, I'll definitely have to put that in. But and not in this instance, but I did have a boss who I didn't particularly get on with that I did base Olivia's boss on for a while. So that was just, you know, that's a bit of a writer being playful, I think. When I first started to think about the book, I went for a big long walk and thought, right, I really do need to think about what I'm going to write next today. And I set myself that goal and I went for a huge walk up to the lighthouse in Byron Bay, which I think is quite a kind of spiritual area anyway. Well, it helped me think. And I started to tell myself a story of a friendship between a much older woman and a younger woman. And a friendship that doesn't start off terribly auspiciously, that the younger woman feels slightly trapped in this older woman's house to begin with. And that's really where the friendship between Olivia and Beatrix comes in. And then I started to really think about women's friendship and female friendship in a broader sense. And then that's where the women in 1945, the five friends, Bee, Plum, Bubbles, Joy and Lucy came forth, really. Yeah. And I wanted to write about friendship, not in a terribly saccharine way, and not in a, very Pollyanna-ish way, but also that is very strong because of what they go through. But yes, they were in really tough circumstances and they go through a lot. But at the end of it, the friendship really stands the test of time, I suppose.
It does. Kate Nunn is my guest in the Writers on Nightlife on ABC Radio tonight. Her new book is called The Last Reunion. So this Netsky, Kate, it goes through a number of hands in The Last Reunion. It makes its first appearance in Burma in 1944, where a serviceman finds it in a ditch and presumably it was lost by a Japanese soldier. And you've built this story around this group that you mentioned, and they were called the Wasbys. Now, who were the Wasbys?
That's the anagram or an acronym for the Women's Auxiliary Service Burma. And I had never heard of these women. And it was only really through a Wikipedia entry that really first sparked my interest. There's an awful lot of historical fiction around at the moment about the Second World War, which a lot of it is fascinating, and it's starting to tell women's stories as well, which I think is really important. But I hadn't come across one set in Burma, and so I was really kind of quite excited and thought, right, well, I really want to write this, and I better do it quickly in case anybody else finds the idea as well. And there wasn't a great deal of information about them. It was originally founded as a group of women who were cypherettes in India, and then that was disbanded. And
so what was a cypherette?
They sort of decoded messages.
Right.
And that was disbanded for various reasons, and then they were reformed and aimed to supply the troops on the front line they drove trucks through the jungle, through the monsoon muds, often under really trying conditions. They would sometimes turn up at their next spot and there would be nowhere for them to stay. And they did camp a lot, but they, you know, sometimes arrived in the middle of the monsoon. There's a story I discovered of them arriving somewhere in the middle of the night and nobody was expecting them. And they were forced to sit on their tin boxes, which is where they kept their personal belongings, with their monsoon capes on and just shiver until morning, until something somewhere could be found for them. So they, you know, and they did this with incredible good humor and uncomplainingly. They dished out endless cups of tea and cake called char and wads to the soldiers and really just lent a friendly ear. They were also, they served the closest to the front line of any women's unit in the Second World War, which I think is quite extraordinary, often under enemy gunfire. And they were the first people to greet the returning prisoners of war from the Burma Railway. So when they were flown out of the camps, they landed and the women were there to greet them. And really, they were instructed to try and act as if everything was normal. And they kind of took their arms and gave them a meal and had to just kind of be very gentle with these poor traumatized men. So it was an absolutely fascinating fascinating area of the water just to research. I found a couple of pamphlets in kind of antiquarian booksellers overseas, one recently published diary, which was incredibly useful. And then also the Imperial War Museum in London has a number of oral histories on its website that I could luckily listen to from Australia and just download them. And to hear women who'd been through it speak in their own words about their experiences and what they say, the language they use, but also what they don't say is really invaluable. And then I was incredibly fortunate in the course of my research to come across Elsa Hatfield, who is alive and very well, living in Melbourne, and she's a former WASB. So to have the chance to chat to somebody who was actually there was just fantastic. You don't often get that in researching historical fiction, well, certainly not the time periods I've written about previously.
And with the reflection of all those years that had passed, when you spoke to her, was she able to bring a different perspective on it from some of those oral histories that you were listening to?
It was actually very similar. Very similar. And I think a lot of people skate over the worst of things. They really don't want to dwell on it. So she talked more about the friendships and the things she saw and the places she went. But that was incredibly useful.
Yeah, you write about them greeting all of those people who'd been liberated from the prisoner of war camps in Burma. And was that something that they told you as well, or that you know, you heard in those oral histories, that shock that they saw or they felt when they saw these people who were barely looked human anymore?
I know. That was mainly from the diaries that I was able to read. And then I did quite a lot of research on the prisoners of war experiences and looked at their artwork. And when I was researching, I really had to limit myself to just a couple of hours a day because it was incredibly distressing and got so much worse for them, but just absolutely heartbreaking.
We are talking to Kate Nunn, whose new book is called The Last Reunion. So how many women were in the WASBs?
I think there were probably slightly less than 500 at any one time, and they operated in canteens of five people. So four of the women would go out in the truck and serve the men in the field on the edge of the battleground or just a few miles behind. And one woman would stay behind and do all the kind of the ordering and the stock taking and try and make the books balance, because they had to do that as well. They also were helped by a number of local Indian cooks who would sometimes have to make ovens out of beaten together cigarette cartons, boxes, metal cigarette boxes, sat on bricks. And their ingenuity was quite extraordinary. They obviously had, you know, supply chain in the time of war is often really tricky. And they'd go to their supply depot and, they'd, you know, there might be hundreds and hundreds of notebooks, but no pens, all that kind of stuff they had to deal with. They operated a lending library. They each brought their own books and records and kind of pooled that so that they had, in certain areas where they were based, where they were in more in a static canteen, they were able to operate a lending library. They did really kind of clever, you know, ingenious things. So they were always losing their mugs. So they had a system where they made the soldiers leave their hat for in return for a mug of tea, and they only got the hat back when they returned the mug.
Oh, I love it. So where were the women recruited from? Because the characters are in the book are all sort of, you know, they're part of the end of British colonialism in India, and they've been brought up in the area. Was that where actually most of them came from, or from further afield?
It was, well, actually further afield as well. So there was quite a strong Australian contingent. There was some sort of rule then that they couldn't recruit from English women based in England. I'm not entirely sure why. So they wanted women and girls who had had some experience in India and in that climate, who knew what to deal with. Some who might speak a bit of Urdu or a bit of Hindustani, that, you know, kind of the local language as well, was quite useful. But what they really wanted, I researched and found advertisements, recruitment advertisements in the Melbourne Age, for example. They wanted women of a certain kind of moral character and strength of mind. And they certainly needed it.
Now, when I think of World War II in Burma, Kate, my mind automatically jumps to the railway and by extension the camps. But yes. Was there actually active fighting sort of going on in Burma more or less the whole time?
Yes. Oh, yes, there was. Absolutely. And there was sort of advances and retreats. And it was a very long fought war. It was actually the longest theatre of war in the Second World War. So it started much sooner than a lot of the other hostilities, and was one of the last, with the bombing of Hiroshima in Japan, to finish the war.
Yeah. So you mentioned that they got closer than any other women to the front line. Did any actually end up getting, you know, injured or caught in the crossfire?
I did read of some women who did die. Sometimes it was accidents. You know, it might be a plane gone down that they were on, a transport that they were on getting from one place to another. But not actually on the battlefield that I could tell. Quite a number of the women were mentioned in dispatches for their bravery, and they did operate under the sound of gunfire. And several were awarded OBEs after the war. So they really did contribute to the morale. And I think the general in charge of the 14th Army at the time, General Frankie Festing, really understood from the letters I read just how important morale was to his men in such a remote part of the world.
Yes, I suppose for men who just see nothing but other men and fighting and all the awful experiences for months, to have a woman to smile at and hand him a cup of tea must have seemed very pleasant.
Yes, yes. And there were quite a number of Indian troops there as well. And I think some of the women initially found it quite disconcerting because the Indians looked at them like they'd never even seen a white woman before. I mean, some of them would, but some of them might not have done. So they had to just get on with things and be very stoic. And that's character really drew me to writing their stories as well, or imagining their stories.
So why do you think, Kate, after all the, you know, only you had to look hard to find their story, why do you think it's not really remembered today?
I think it's just a small fragment of a much bigger war. And it's been largely forgotten, just as the stories of women until fairly recently and their contribution have been overlooked. This is, you know, a smaller element that has been overlooked.
Do you know, we comment often here in the office, because we've got many books that get sent to us, that there just seems to be this entire genre of historical fiction set in war. I mean, you were just saying before, you know, I've got to jump on my idea about the Wasbys before anybody else gets to it. I mean, when you look around, I mean, are you surprised by the number of people who are writing historical fiction about the Second World War?
I think at the moment there's enough of a distance that people feel they can begin to fictionalize it. In terms of writing fiction set in war, it's a time of heightened emotions and heightened activity. So it's really quite dramatic. It lends itself to extremes, I suppose, which makes it more of a kind of compelling, fascinating read.
And I think it's a great service that's done as well. All these forgotten stories, as you know, like this one about the Wasbys, all the people who read your book will be learning about them, where, you know, perhaps if not for this book, they might have gone the rest of their lives without ever knowing about them.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes. No, it's nice to be able to contribute in a very small way in that sense.
I was like, Kate, what drew you to write historical fiction?
I love the idea of events in the past coming home to roost in the present, and secrets in the past coming home to roost in the present. I also, I love the research side of it, and just, you know, going down wormholes and finding out all kinds of irrelevant things. I do love the research side of it. I also like the way that, I'm fascinated by the way that events in the past can leave their mark on a place in a physical sense. You know, you can see objects that were handled by people who are now long gone from this world. And how do you begin to think about their lives and imagine their lives? And, you know, often their lives would have been very different, but a lot of their preoccupations and their worries, their loves, their hates, all those kind of things would have been remarkably similar to what we experience today.
Now, last year, you won the Winston Graham Historical Fiction Award for your book, The Botanist's Daughter. Just tell me about that award. I mean, Winston Graham, as I'm sure many people know, is the author of the Poldark book. So tell us about that.
I was really so delighted by that. Absolutely thrilled, because I grew up with the novels of Winston Graham and the original Poldark series on the television, which will date me. As a child, I remember watching it. And I've also spent a lot of childhood holidays and summers in Cornwall in a place called Polzeth. And so when I started to think about where to set The Botanist's Daughter, that place came to mind. So it was just absolutely delightful. And in a lovely twist of kind of circularity, I suppose. The chairman of judges, Philip Marsden, is a very well-known writer in the UK. And years ago, in my early 20s, I think in my second job, I worked for a publisher and we published his first novel. I mean, he wouldn't remember me at all and wouldn't have remembered my name. But it was really quite special to have him as the chair of judges of this award.
And this award, is this right? I understand that basically it's for books set in that region.
Set in the southwest of England, yes. So Cornwall and Devon and potentially the Scilly Isles, that area, yes.
And is that, as you know, it's something Winston Graham actually left a bequest for? Is that something he really wanted to?
Yes. Yes, his widow, definitely. Right. Yes, she's on the judging panel as well.
Well, if anyone's done a good job of bringing Cornwall to life, it's certainly Winston Graham and those Poldark novels, isn't it?
Oh, they're fantastic, yes.
All right, which series did you like better, first or the second?
Both. I really loved both. I thought the actors in the contemporary series are just phenomenal, and the cinematography is so beautiful in that. It really makes Cornwall and them look stunning.
It does, doesn't it? So, Kate, what's next? Which rabbit holes are you going to be ferreting down or burrowing into next?
I'm working on a kind of a draft before I'm ready to submit it to my agent of a novel that, again, has a dual timeline. So it's set in 2013 and then in 1949. And all I can really say about it is that it opens with the murder of an elderly nun in a nursing home. And it's also concerned with kind of women, the ill treatment of women through history, which is kind of something I have a bit of a preoccupation with.
Well, that's a pretty good opening hook, so we will look forward to hearing about it. Hey, Kate, thanks so much for joining us on Nightlife to tell us about The Last Reunion.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That is Kate Nunn, and her new book is called The Last Reunion.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.